I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
That's right, everyone. It's your turn to tell the media how you're feeling about election coverage.
What I want to hear is actual news and not a lot of emphasis on the rhetoric.
How news agencies are trying to prevent voter misdirection.
I don't want to hear predictions about who's going to win.
There's an unprecedented amount of noise at the moment.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Thursday, October 15th, a little self-reflection. Plus, the census winds down earlier than expected, protest against police violence in Nigeria, and our lead story today, a possible turning point in Black representation in the Senate. All right, let's get to it. Throughout American history, there have only been 10 Black senators. But this year could be a turning point for Black representation in the United States Senate. Some of these candidates are also bringing in record amounts of money, something that candidates of color have historically struggled to do. The most high profile of these candidates is perhaps Jamie Harrison. The former head of South Carolina's Democratic Party, Harrison is neck and neck with the Republican incumbent Senator Lindsey Graham. Harrison's campaign recently made headlines for raising a record-breaking $57 million in one quarter alone.
It's time for us to come together as a people, and I hope through my campaign, a campaign that is built on hope, that folks will see that and say that it's time for a new day.
Over in Mississippi, Democrat Mike Espy has also seen a big boost in fundraising in recent weeks in his race against Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith.
I'm not going back to yesteryear. We all want to move forward. That's the kind of senator that I want to be.
Over in Georgia, polls are showing the Reverend Raphael Warnock soaring past the top two Republicans in his state, including incumbent Senator Kelly Loeffler. And over in Michigan, Democratic Senator Gary Peters is still leading in the polls, but Black Republican candidate John James is gaining ground.
I am not standing here on this stage because of socialism. I'm standing here because of free enterprise and free will and because self-determination works.
With more high-profile Black Senate contenders on the ballot this year than ever before and more money flowing into their campaigns, 2021 could be a historic year in terms of what Congress actually looks like. Joining me now are Amanda Turkle, Washington bureau chief at HuffPost, and Andra Gillespie, a political scientist at Emory University. Amanda and Andra, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Hi.
Andra, let's start with you. What can we attribute to this rise in Black Senate candidates this year? Why are there so many folks running for office?
Well, this is an opportune year for Democrats to run for office, as evidenced by the number who tried to run for president. People see a lot of dissatisfaction with the course the country is going in, a lot of dissatisfaction with the Trump administration, and they think that that's actually going to have an impact on the chances of Democrats to be able to win races up and down the ticket. And given the fact that African Americans make up anywhere from a quarter to a fifth of the Democratic Party coalition, it's not surprising that you would see so many African American candidates, particularly the Democratic candidates, throw their hat in the race to run for office. There's just this deep bench within the Democratic Party coalition. And we've seen Democratic candidates, Black Democratic candidates, do well in recent years, even if they haven't won office. So, I think the idea that Black candidates are permanently, disadvantaged because of their race is something that's openly being challenged by the performance of these candidates in races.
And Andra, I'm curious about the money that we're seeing flowing into some of these campaigns. What's driving some of that?
Well, money is a signal of competitiveness. It's like investment. So if people see a product and they think that it's going to be successful, they're willing to actually put their capital behind it. And then the same way with candidates, if somebody sees that a candidate has a chance of winning is a candidate who's well positioned to perform well in an election, you're going to see people put their resources behind that particular candidate. And so I say the fundraising that we've seen, particularly for Jamie Harrison in South Carolina, is a sign that, one, he's well-networked, but also that people actually view his race as actually being viable.
Amanda, speaking of Jamie Harrison, he's probably, as we mentioned, the most high profile of the Black Senate candidates this year. He's generated a ton of buzz. He's also generated a ton of money. How close is the race there now? I mean, what are the most recent polls telling us?
Yeah, Harrison, he is now polling about even with Graham. And of the Black Senate candidates this cycle, he is the closest. You know, Harrison is getting a lot of attention, not only because he is running a good race, but also because of who he's running against. Lindsey Graham is sort of a villain to a lot of Democrats, and even more so now that you have him as chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee helping to push through Amy Coney Barrett for the Supreme Court. And so that's a big reason that Jamie Harrison saw such an influx of money after Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death and when Trump made it clear he was going to nominate someone before the election. And, you know, again, all the Senate Democrats, Senate Democratic candidates saw a lot of donations, but Harrison is a real focus for the party.
And Amanda, do we know where these donations are coming from? I mean, a lot of candidates often talk about, particularly presidential candidates, have often talked about how small donors are really making the difference. Particularly in the Harris campaign, but in the other campaigns that we're going to talk about, is this largely super PAC money? Is it individuals? What do we know?
It is a lot of small donors. A lot of it is coming from out of state in the South Carolina race, and that's not just for Harrison, but for Graham as well. It's attracting a lot of national attention, as did, say, Stacey Abrams, who was running in Georgia. But, you know, Black candidates often have had trouble getting establishment support. They are often newer to politics, not always, but sometimes, and they just face these institutional hurdles and higher barriers to showing that they're viable. And the main way to show that they're viable is through donations. And so the establishment is sometimes slow to get behind these candidates. Harrison does have the support of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, which is in charge of electing Democrats to the Senate, as do the other all but one of the other Black Senate candidates this cycle. But some of them feel like they haven't gotten enough money from the party. It's taken too long for, you know, the party bigwigs to notice them. And they've told me that they still face questions about, can a Democrat really win in your state? And can a Black Democrat really win? And so those barriers are still there. But people like Stacey Abrams and her historic run are helping to knock them down, as I'm sure these candidates will as well.
Andra, I'm curious about that because I want to sort of tackle that question head on. You know, can a Black Democrat win, for example, in South Carolina? But is that question something that a lot of Black candidates are running into?
It is a question that Black candidates have faced historically across the country, but in particular in the South. And it's relevant because there is racial polarization in party identification and voting. And so if you have the vast majority of whites in the state identifying and voting as Republican, and Blacks only make up 30% of the state and are the vast majority of the Democratic voters in the state, then you just have a numerical problem. There just aren't enough Democrats to be able to sort of make up for the whites who are voting Republican. So the question there is whether or not that's a problem of being Black or whether that's a problem of being Democrat. And so the two have often been conflated. And what the candidacies of people like Stacey Abrams and Andrew Gillum showed us in 2018 was that the problem may be more about being a Democrat in a state that has more Republicans than Democrats than it is really about being Black. That doesn't mean that Black candidates don't face racial attacks, right? We saw them both, those nasty robocalls against Gillum and Abrams in 2018, the allegations of voter suppression. But if we look at the overall numbers, we see how close the two of them got in 2018. We see the fact that in Georgia, Stacey Abrams, in terms of absolute number of votes, got more votes than the whites who had previously run for that seat in 2014 and in 2010, right? We can see that, you know, people can figure out how to navigate around the challenges that are unique to them because of their racial identities. The rest of it is an issue of party building, and that's a challenge that anybody is going to face. And so you can't just assume that if you put a white candidate forward, that they're going to be any more viable than the Black candidate was.
And to that point, Andra, I'm wondering, is that – you mentioned Andrew Gillum and Stacey Abrams. I'm wondering if that – they were also able to appeal to white voters in getting as close as they did.
Well, so this is interesting, and my colleagues and I have debates about this. I would argue yes. Some of my colleagues would disagree because they are comparing them to how Barack Obama presented himself in 2008. And we look at Barack Obama as the quintessential deracialized black candidate who really tried to de-emphasize race and to forge cross-racial bonds. And in 2018, because we're running in the Trump era, you're running at that point after Charlottesville, after Ferguson, race has become front and center. Sort of in American discourse and certainly in the Democratic Party platform. And so they ran more racially overt campaigns because the salience of the issues in many ways demanded that they do so. But they didn't do so at the exclusion or to the exclusion of trying to build cross-racial coalitions. So I would actually argue that what we've seen happen, and I talk about this in my latest book about selective deracialization, of figuring out when it's appropriate to pivot, and then also in some ways moving towards things that actually do have cross-racial appeal. So, you know, a safe one right now is talking about voting rights, right? Like that is an issue that harkens back to the classic long civil rights movement of the 20th century. Nobody would object to that. Policing is becoming something that is more mainstream, so it actually doesn't look like it is, like it's going to be something that's particularly controversial. But you see people shying away from defunding the police, for instance, which would
and that's something we're going to get into a lot more on the show, just in terms of where policing stands. But I want to make sure before we end the segment here that we talk about some of the other candidates. Amanda, Mike Espy over in Mississippi, his campaign seems to be doing relatively well. Where does that stand right now?
Right. He ran before and he is running again. He is a little bit closer to his Republican opponent, Cindy Hyde-Smith. He ran against her before. And he is a candidate who and when he ran last time, he was criticized for, you know, why aren't you talking about race more? And he said that was a mistake. He told me that this is a different time now. And he said that he felt like a lot of young people couldn't connect with his campaign because he didn't talk about his history, fighting segregation, you know, integrating his school and getting called the N-word and having teachers cursing and spraying fire extinguishers at him. And he's doing it this time because he realizes it's an important part of who he is and he wants to be able to connect with young people. And the other candidate that I want to highlight is Raphael Warnock. He is the senior pastor at Ebenezer Baptist Church. He is running in Georgia in the open special election, and he's pulling ahead. But right now the problem is that he's in this open race where he's running against other Democrats and other Republicans, and you have to get a majority of the votes in order to avoid a runoff. And so the question is, can he avoid a runoff, or will he face off against one of the other Republicans? But expect Democrats to be paying a lot more attention to his race.
Amanda, we got about 40 seconds left. What about Black Republican candidate John James in about 40 seconds? Does he have a chance?
He has a chance. He does have a chance. He's pulling a little bit behind Democrat Gary Peters, but he's someone that Republicans are very excited about this cycle as well.
We will be paying attention to all these historic runs. Amanda Turkle is Washington Bureau Chief at HuffPost, and Andra Gillespie is a political scientist at Emory University. Amanda, Andra, thanks to you both.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. And as we enter the final stages of this election cycle, it's getting pretty hard to keep track of all the major news stories happening at once. This week alone has included Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation hearings, the start to in-person voting in multiple states, and tonight, competing televised town halls for President Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden in place of a traditional presidential debate. So with so much going on, we wanted to check in with our listeners. And we asked what stories and angles you think The Takeaway and other news outlets should focus on as we head into November. And we heard one theme again and again.
This is Deborah from Tampa. I'd like to hear about voter suppression, where it's going on and how people can avoid being caught up in that and what they can do to counteract it.
Well, my name is Fred from Charlotte, North Carolina. What I'd like to know is, why is it so hard to vote? Why do we have to wait in line for hours to vote? I'm going to vote for Biden. But I'd like to know why he's been in politics for 47 years and has never done anything about it.
The most important thing I'd like to hear leading up to the election is how news agencies and platforms like Facebook are trying to prevent voter misdirection.
I'm Sherry from St. Charles, Missouri. I don't want to hear predictions about who's going to win or how close the vote is going to be. I want to know what will make voting easier. I'd like to know how many people are being signed up to vote and what chance we have of people actually getting to the polls.
Here to talk more about how the media is covering the 2020 election so far is Aaron Haynes, the editor-at-large for the 19th. Aaron, thanks for being back with us on the show.
Good to be with you, Tanzina.
Also with us is Jane Costin, senior politics reporter at Vox. Great to have you with us, Jane.
Thanks so much for having me.
Aaron, we heard a bunch of callers saying that they want to know more about voters, voter suppression, why the lines are so long. How would you assess how the media, quote unquote, has been covering these issues so far?
Well, I think that there has been an increased focus on the threat of voter suppression, and that was true even before the pandemic, although the pandemic has certainly exacerbated these issues. And with early voting starting this week in states like Texas, Tennessee, and my home state of Georgia, where I'm seeing Black folks showing up with snacks, folding chairs, and phone chargers because they already know the deal, right? We're also seeing record turnout and this dogged determination to vote. I suspect we'll probably see similar lines in North Carolina, which began early voting on Thursday. But I just want to emphasize, there is kind of a media narrative that I'm seeing that I would hope that we don't normalize by saying things like, you know, but voters say it's worth it. I mean, of course it's worth it. This is a democracy, and the idea of one person, one vote is sacrosanct in this country. But that doesn't mean that people should have to wait online for 9 hours to exercise their right as a citizen. And we know who those voters usually are: voters of color, the elderly, the poor. And in a pandemic, this is also including white voters for whom this is not a regular experience. So maybe this is going to be a wake-up call to them about the realities of voter suppression for far too many in this country, because this is something that we're going to need to address, not just in this election, but going forward.
It's an excellent point that you make there, Aaron, about how the heroics of voting, when voting is essentially a part of our democracy, or supposed to be, at least. Jane, bringing you in here, Leslie Savin recently wrote in the New Republic about cable news and how she suggested that they should devote the same energy to covering voter suppression that they do to covering polling. We just heard, Jane, one of our callers say, "Don't tell me who's predicting anything. Tell me why voting is so hard." What do cable news outlets have to be mindful of, Jane? Because it often feels like, you know, you're going back and forth for hours and not really giving a lot of substantive information.
Right. I've often joked that cable news is sports for people who don't like sports, but there is no reason to cover this election or any election like a sporting event. I think that polling, especially because polling relies on statistical analysis and on an understanding that polls are not themselves predictive, and making predictions based on polling is a fool's errand, as we've learned time and time and time again. Polls are snapshots in time. They just tell you essentially what you had for breakfast this morning. They don't tell you what's for dinner tonight. So I think that it's really important to keep in mind that what these polls look like and how cable news thinks about voting and voter suppression. And I really agree that so much of the language that we use about voters, you should not need to get a chair out to prepare to wait in line for 3 hours. And it's interesting because some of the responses from conservatives have implied that the issue is actually early voting and the limited number of early voting facilities, which lends to long lines, which the answer to which is, why aren't there more facilities that can facilitate early voting? So I think, though, that the focus should be on what voter suppression looks like in all forms. And let's keep in mind that there's also voter suppression online. We've seen actions and a lot of really interesting research done on efforts by foreign actors and by people in this own country, in our own country, to suppress the vote by essentially implying online, whether on social media or elsewhere, that voting doesn't matter, or that, you know, how to vote, but doing so in an incorrect way. And so I think it's important to keep in mind what that looks like in all of its forms.
Also, I'm wondering, you know, Aaron, when it comes to coverage of the latest polls, once again, a lot of folks are talking about Joe Biden being in the lead. The president is trailing. Is that sort of, you know, is that helpful right now for media consumers?
Well, I think that Democrats, and specifically the Biden campaign, is certainly trying to make sure that voters don't get lulled into a false sense of security from the polls, right? I think given what we saw in 2016 around the polling, that did have an effect on some voters who said, oh, well, you know, my vote's not going to matter, or, you know, Hillary Clinton has it in the bag, so it doesn't really matter if I don't have time to get over to the polls. You know, what difference is it going to make? And then we saw what difference it made. But you know, to Jane's point, I think that part of this conversation does have to also include asking, you know, because we had months to prepare, we saw in the primary some of these issues, why weren't states ready? Like, we have to continue to be asking that question. What were the issues? And, you know, also the issue of voter depression, that is also what those efforts look like in the 21st century. And so particularly in battleground states, where we know this election could come down to a matter of voter suppression versus voter turnout, it's important to stay on top of these things and also to disabuse people of the notion that voter suppression is a Jim Crow relic. Voter suppression is active, and it is absolutely still with us in this generation.
Erin, it sounds pretty straightforward. They want to hear what's really happening and not rhetoric. And yet tonight there will be two town halls, one on NBC, where the president, President Trump, will be able to address the nation, and one on ABC, where former Vice President Joe Biden will be able to do the same. Is that just going to be more rhetoric? Is this serving the American public?
Well, you know, Tanzina, I actually was looking forward to a town hall debate. I do feel that those are productive, and it's a different dynamic because the candidates do have to engage directly with the voters, as opposed to, you know, at a campaign rally where it is, you know, candidates talking to their supporters, right? This is supposed to be about the sliver of people in this country who say that they are still undecided. And so it's disappointing that voters are going to have to choose between watching one or the other, or watching neither, which is not really an option for people like us, you know, who are covering this, or flipping back and forth, or just waiting for the highlights on social media. But this is a president who we know has broken norms for the past 5 years, first as a candidate and now as commander in chief. And so tonight is really going to be the latest example of that. And it's not ideal for democracy or for those of us who are attempting to cover this highly consequential election with just one more debate scheduled and the election less than 3 weeks away.
And Jane, to that point about rhetoric, there was a recent study from Harvard University that found that President Trump and Fox News were leading the spread of disinformation, specifically around mail-in voting and voter fraud ahead of the election. And, you know, this is something, and I'm sure, Erin, you all think about this over at the 19th. We think about this here on The Takeaway a lot, how to cover false information coming from the president when it's news. Jane, what are your thoughts on that?
I think it's worth noting here that one of the ways you can tell that this information is false is that the false information is not given to everyone. You'll note that Trump is very supportive of mail-in voting if you happen to be a Florida Republican or a Republican in virtually any other state, in which case mail-in voting is extremely safe and an amazing idea. But I think something that Vox, my publication, does that I think is effective is what we do, essentially what you would call a sandwich of information. So you have the facts, then you have whatever the false claim is, and then you back it up with the facts again. And I think that one of the things I'm interested in, because I think that too often in our media environment, we just recite whatever Trump said and then attempt to like define it or argue against it. But I think it's more interesting and more effective to talk about why he is saying this in the first place. People who are doing extremely well in campaigns may not necessarily argue that too many people are voting or that voting should be done in a very specific way. So I think it's more interesting to get at why the message is being made and not necessarily what the message is.
Erin, one of the things that's come out from our callers, one of the themes that's also come out is that people want to hear the actual coverage. We've heard we don't want to hear predictions. We don't want to hear rhetoric. We want to hear coverage of the issues. Because of the last presidential debate and how it really essentially went off the rails, there was very little talk of policy. Has there been enough coverage of the actual issues and platforms that the candidates are running on that's not obfuscated by the candidates themselves?
Well, I will tell you that we are trying mightily over at the 19th Tanzina, focusing on really hearing from voters, just as that caller that you had at the top of the segment mentioned, hearing what matters to them, talk to Latina voters about how this is an existential election to them, talking to women who we know are the majority of the electorate, and how the pandemic is absolutely political for them, both from a public health and an economic standpoint, and how that is factoring into their choices at the ballot box. The essential and frontline workers who are thinking about, how the pandemic, what the plan is going to be going forward for the pandemic, and also laying out the issues that matter to voters. We know that in addition to the dual pandemics of coronavirus and systemic racism, voters care still very much about health care, about the economy, about education, about childcare, right, and the new normal going forward on the other side of this pandemic, around workplace issues. And then lastly, the process of voting, having voter guides so that voters have a trusted place that they can go if they are confused because of the mixed messaging coming from our government, and competing messages that are just kind of out in the ecosystem, having a place where they can go to understand, to make a plan, and to feel empowered. We would be remiss as a newsroom named for the 19th Amendment if we did not do that duty for our members and readers.
I know a lot of people probably very much appreciate that. Jane, speaking of misinformation, predictions, rhetoric, one last thing to talk about here is that this week, President Trump's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, who has previously spread misinformation about Joe Biden and his son Hunter, shared claims about Hunter Biden with the New York Post, a conservative tabloid here in New York City. The Biden campaign has disputed that reporting, but this was sort of reminiscent, Jane, of 2016 for a lot of journalists.
It's interesting, though, because you might compare it to running the exact same play as 2016, but against a different candidate, and more interestingly, against that candidate's son. And if President Trump wants to get into the involvement of family in family business, he perhaps could spend a great deal of time focused on the actions of his own family. But I think it's worth noting a lot of this discussion became focused on how social media platforms dealt with it. And I think that social media platforms, I think, jumped the gun on this issue, because I think the actual piece itself, there is so much concern about the false information contained within it, especially because it involves Rudy Giuliani and Steve Bannon, and especially because information within it clearly was meant to be brought out in late 2019. But I think it's worth challenging this information without spreading it. But I think that whether people want to spread it on social media, that should be left up to individuals. I think platforms making these decisions then turns it into a larger discussion about content on social media platforms instead of an effort by Rudy Giuliani, formerly quote-unquote America's mayor, going after the son of a presidential candidate for crimes alleged by Ukrainian entities. And then it becomes one about content moderation.
Lots to consider. Jane Costin is a senior politics reporter at Vox, and Aaron Haynes is the editor at large for the 19th. Thanks to you both for joining me.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Jessica. I'm calling from Long Island. I want to hear more about the ACA and what we can do to make it stay around. Somebody with multiple sclerosis and another autoimmune disorder and about six other diagnoses. And my MS-1 medication is literally $1 million per year. So I'm screwed, to put it mildly, if the ACA gets undone.
Hi, this is Matt Wagner calling from New York City. And I know there's an unprecedented amount of noise at the moment, but I'm nonetheless surprised at how little attention is being paid to LGBTQ issues in this election. Not only are there huge concerns around trans access to healthcare and equitable life generally, but LGBTQs have also been among the communities most severely impacted by COVID.
Hi, this is Al calling from Orlando. At this point in the election, what we need to hear is, what are all the programs that the candidates have? None of the noise. I don't want to hear about anyone's emails. But what programs? What are you going to put on the table if you're given the keys to the White House?
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, everybody. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. It's been more than a week of protests against police brutality in Nigeria. Tens of thousands of Nigerians have taken to the streets where police officers have opened fire on demonstrators and arrested hundreds. At least 10 protesters have been killed so far. Protesters have been calling for police reform and specifically the end of a unit that has been accused of human rights abuses. The unit is called the Specialized Anti-Robbery Squad, or SARS. Over the weekend, the president of Nigeria said the unit would be disbanded, but demonstrators remain skeptical and are continuing to protest until all of their demands are met. Joining us now is the BBC's Nigeria correspondent, Mayeni Jones from Lagos. Welcome to the show, Mayeni.
Hi, Tanzina.
So we said that people are protesting this unit, but what was there something that set off the protest to begin with?
So the protests initially started early in October when a video appeared on social media appearing to show some young men being dragged by SARS officers out of a hotel. It's unclear when the video was taken, but it was shared very widely on social media in Nigeria and started a resurgence in a hashtag that had been seen in the past, which was the hashtag #EndSARS. This hashtag first appeared, we think, in 2018 and had been used a couple of times before when similar videos had been posted showing SARS officers allegedly brutalizing members of the public. But this time around, it picked up a lot of speed, and this movement, this youth-led movement that seems quite organic, has emerged from it.
What types of policing tactics are Nigerians protesting, and who are SARS targeting generally?
So Nigerians have been protesting everything from extortion to torture to extrajudicial killings. They say that members of SARS particularly are allowed to act with impunity and target often young members of the public who perhaps are carrying mobile phones or laptop. They accuse them of being internet scammers. They also occasionally target people driving nice cars, particularly if they're young or female, asking them how they made their money. And they say that these practices are completely unacceptable and that they're taking advantage of their position as plainclothes policemen to extort people for money and carry out brutal acts of violence against members of the public.
Now, we mentioned that the president of Nigeria has since said that he would disband this unit, but protesters are still wanting demands to be met. What specific demands are they asking for, Mayeni?
So they have a number of demands. They have five key demands. They want all protesters to be released. They've asked for justice for victims of police brutality who've been killed and compensation for their family. They want an independent body to oversee an investigation into police misconduct. They've also asked for a psychological evaluation and retraining of members of SARS, and they want increased salaries for policemen across the board.
Protesters have been killed by law enforcement, about 10 people we understand so far. Has there been any accountability or justice for those people?
So that's one of the key reasons why protesters are still out on the street despite the dissolution of SARS. For them, the dissolution doesn't constitute any actual justice for victims. And they say the fact that people have been killed during this protest and no officer has been charged, no investigation's been launched, nothing appears to have been done, shows that the authorities are not committed to reforming police in any substantive way. And they say that they'll keep coming out onto the streets until they see some actual change beyond just rhetoric from the government, beyond promises of reforms that they say they've seen before. They want to see officers charged, they want to see changes put into law, and they want to be assured that police officers in Nigeria will no longer be allowed to act with impunity.
Let's talk a little bit about who these protesters are. Are they largely young people? Are they women? Are they men? Who are we seeing that's taking to the streets?
That's what's been very interesting about this latest wave of protests. It's just the sheer diversity of people who've gotten involved. You have members of the Nigerian diaspora sending money from abroad, from the US, from Canada, from the UK. You have young middle-class people who live in Nigeria, who were educated abroad, who are lending their skills, be it legal skills, medical skills, skills in logistics and organizing. And then you have, you know, ordinary Nigerians, perhaps who've lived here their whole lives, who are often targeted by the police because they're seen as powerless or not so well connected. All these diverse groups are coming together at these protests because they say that the violence committed by SARS and the wider police, because this is also a protest about abuses of the police in Nigeria as a whole, affect everyone.
One thing that's been discussed is that the Nigerian government said they would disband SARS, but they have already introduced a different unit named SWAT. Is this the same thing and different with a different name?
That's the accusation that's been leveled at the government. I think people were particularly skeptical because of the speed with which this new special weapons and tactics team, or SWAT, was set up. They say that it shows that this was just a knee-jerk reaction from the authorities, and particularly from the head of police, and that it's not being thought through, that it's just going to be SARS, but perhaps more heavily armed and with a different name. They're completely distrustful. There's been a breakdown of trust completely between the police, the government, and young people in Nigeria. So many people are looking towards SWAT, and within an hour of the announcement being made that it would be formed, the hashtag #EndSWAT started. And when we hit protests in Lagos during the week, there were already a number of signs up saying #EndSWAT.
This is happening in a moment here in the United States where we've seen, at least the past couple of months, really an uprising for racial justice, particularly against police brutality. Would you say that there's some of this influence, that has maybe influenced some young people in Nigeria?
Definitely, speaking to protesters here, there's a sense that it's a particularly interesting moment in time. I think many of them, yes, were inspired by what they saw in America this year. I think there's also been recently protests that have been led by young people, particularly the Sudanese protests last year, that show that young Africans could effect change in their country. And I think many young people are frustrated in the wake of seeing both those protests and the change that they've made, that things for them in Nigeria are not changing. I think the pandemic has also been instrumental. Many people have found themselves stuck at home, their livelihoods shattered, and they realize that their governments can do very little for them, whereas governments in other countries have stepped in, paid salaries, helped out in some way. The Nigerian government hasn't been able to do that in any substantive way. And I think all of these elements have come together to create the perfect storm in which we found ourselves right now.
Myeni Jones is the BBC's Nigeria correspondent. Myeni, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
On Tuesday, the Supreme Court approved a request by the Trump administration to end the census count by 11:59 p.m. Hawaii Standard Time today. This is just the latest development in a legal back and forth over the census deadlines, which were extended earlier this year because of delays caused by the pandemic. Civil rights advocacy organizations are worried that the Trump administration's decision to end the count early could result in an undercount in the census, which would hurt state funding and misrepresent how many seats a state could have in the House of Representatives for the next decade. We've talked a lot on the show about the ways in which the census matters to various communities. So what happens now? Who better to help us understand all of this than Hansi Lo Wang, NPR's national correspondent on the 2020 census. Hansi, welcome back.
Thank you, Tanzina.
So lots happening. Why did the Trump administration want to end the count today?
The Trump administration says it's trying to meet this legal deadline for reporting the first set of census results to the president, December 31st. That's the date on the books, the law books. But the Census Bureau's top career officials have said since May that because of delays caused by the pandemic, the Bureau can no longer meet that deadline. That's why the Trump administration and President Trump himself called for Congress to pass deadline extensions back in April. Those deadline extensions have not been passed by Congress. December 31st is still that reporting deadline. And the Trump administration, for whatever reason, in July stopped asking Congress to pass those deadline extensions. And instead, another really interesting thing happened. President Trump issued this memo calling for the exclusion of unauthorized immigrants from the census numbers used to apportion to reallocate House seats in the House of Representatives among the states. And what's interesting is that if the Trump administration can meet this December 31st deadline, despite what career officials have said about delays and all the issues with the pandemic, this would allow President Trump to control the numbers, regardless of whether or not he can win re-election.
And we're talking about a 15-day difference here, right? I mean, we were initially, Americans were given till the end of October, and now they're given till the 15th, which is today. Does it really make a difference in terms of how many people will be able to fill out the census, Hansi?
This can make a major difference in many communities across the country where not every person has been counted. Not every person living in the country has been counted. There are tribal areas, states like Louisiana, that have not hit a 99% completion rate, meaning the Bureau has not accounted for at least 99% of the housing units. And we don't know what it looks like in local communities. We only have kind of some insight into what it looks like in certain states. This extra time is what the Bureau has relied on to send out door knockers to really try to convince households that have not yet participated and need that in-person interaction to try to get people to participate. And communities of color, rural residents, renters, these are all historically undercounted groups that time is really the major factor here. Extra time, extra outreach. That's how the Bureau historically has been able to make sure that every person, as close as every person, is counted in the census.
Hansi, what about you mentioned that the president really wants to make sure that undocumented people are not counted in this census count, but can he do that? I mean, doesn't the census not care whether or not someone is documented? It's supposed to be a count of how many people are in this country?
That's right. It's supposed to be a count of every person living in the country. And to be clear, the memo that President Trump issued in July is not about excluding unauthorized immigrants from the census in general. It is specifically from the numbers that are used from the census to determine each state's share of congressional seats, specifically the seats in the House of Representatives. And that is something that the Trump administration is arguing that President Trump has discretion. There is this process where the Census Bureau, through the Commerce Secretary who oversees the Bureau, passes off to the president by December 31st, the current federal law, the latest state population counts. And those are the numbers used to determine each state's share of congressional seats for the next 10 years. And President Trump, whoever is president, is supposed to hand over those numbers to Congress in January. And then Congress, the clerk of the House, is supposed to certify those numbers and inform the state's governors, each of the state's governors. And so this is a multi-step process. President Trump plays a role if he is in the White House in December. And this is something that traditionally presidents have not made major changes or called for major changes like this to who is included in the count, because since 1790, the numbers have included both citizens and non-citizens, regardless of immigration status.
So to that point, will this be challenged in court?
This is something that a court in New York has already blocked the Trump administration from carrying out, that ruling has been appealed to the Supreme Court. And so the Trump administration is trying to get that ruling overturned. And ultimately, I'm watching to see when this becomes officially a Supreme Court fight. We're watching to see exactly if and when the Supreme Court will hear this appeal.
What does that mean then for the census count? Will it be held up because of the potential for an additional Supreme Court battle here, or will we have a sense where things stand before the next president, or before we know who our next president will be?
The counting is set to end today. And so that will be finished in a few hours here. And so exactly what the results of that count will be, we will have to see how this other legal fight over this memo that President Trump wants to carry out, how that plays out. The Trump administration has said they plan to release the latest state population counts, the first set of results, to the president and to the public at the same time. And so December 31st is that legal deadline. We'll see if that does come out in time. And then as for more detailed census results, that's a major question right now, because the Trump administration has not really clarified exactly when they'll be ready to release that information, given all the focus on the memo.
Really important stuff. Hansi Lo Wang is an NPR national correspondent on the 2020 census. Hansi, thanks so much for joining me.
You're welcome, Tanzina.
All right, everybody, that's another Thursday in the books. I'm so glad you were with us this week. Keep coming back to listen. Amy Walter is in tomorrow. I'll be back on Monday, and we're getting close to that election, so stick with us. I just want to say that our crew works so hard to make this show each and every day for you. They are our senior producer, Alexandra Botee. Our producers are Ethan Oberman, Meg Dalton, Jackie Martin, Jason Tureski, Lydia McMullen-Laird, Emily Lang, and Asher Stockler. Jose Olivares line produced this week. Polly Irungu and Dina Syed Ahmed were our digital editors. David Gable is our executive assistant. Debbie Daughtry and Vince Fairchild are our board operators and engineers. Jay Cowett was our director, editor, sound designer, producer, board operator, and sous chef. And our executive producer is Lee Hill. If you missed anything or want to listen back again, you can check out our podcast. And of course, call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.